From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. This was a really fantastic year.
It was wonderful. There were so many cookable cookbooks, and I saw so many new cooks coming into my store to buy them. It was just very encouraging.
I've been talking to Celia Sack about the year's best cookbooks. She's the owner of the San Francisco cookbook store Omnivore Books on Food. It's a Shangri-La for food enthusiasts and bibliophiles. Every December, we turn to her for gift ideas. This is one of my favorite conversations all year.
Same. I always look forward to it.
So what have been some of the standouts this year for you?
Well, okay, so I sort of was giving this some thought before we talked, and I separated out practical, beautiful, memoir, and food history, and those three categories really grew. And then I was also really excited that there were a few really great Mexican cookbooks by Mexicans. So I might start out saying some of those, because I was just so encouraged, and two of them are from your fair city, Los Angeles. El Mexicano by Bill Esparza, and Guerrilla Tacos by Wes Avila. Both of them explore the scene, the Mexican food scene in Los Angeles, and talk about a lot of different Mexican foods that we don't often see in cookbooks. You know, a lot of the cookbooks that have been out in the past sort of have the expected Mexican cuisines, but I feel like these really explore some areas that haven't been touched and that are really popular in Los Angeles and have sort of developed there outside of Mexico. And then from San Francisco, we've got Nopalito by Gonzalo Guzman. And that's a very popular restaurant here. And they've made a cookbook as well. So, you know, I'm just really excited to see the explosion of cookbooks by people actually from Mexico about their own cuisine.
Yeah, it's wonderful to hear those voices.
Yeah, definitely. And then as far as practical cookbooks, I just feel like, you know, I remember talking to you about this last year that finally the sort of coffee table books were on their way out. And I felt like practical cookbooks by cookbook authors who that's their whole career is writing cookbooks are sort of coming back in. And I felt like that really continued this year apace and really great starting points. I mean, we started out last year with Julia Tertian's book, Small Victories. And I feel like from there and from the success of that book, publishers were really encouraged to continue with that trend. So we have Allison Roman's Dining In. We've got Melissa Clark, who writes for the New York Times every week. Her book, Dinner Changing the Game, is wonderful. And she's written so many cookbooks in the past for other people. It's nice to see her own. And then there's the fabulous, probably my bestseller this year is Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat by Samin Nosrat. She used to work at Chez Panisse up here in San Francisco, and she was Michael Pollan's assistant for many years. And this is finally her own book and illustrated by a local illustrator up here named Wendy McNaughton, who did a beautiful job with it, really explaining why salt, fat, acid, and heat are vital to everyone's kitchen and how they make your dinner, basically.
I mean, those are such great books to bring up, especially Samin's. I mean, she is such an extraordinary teacher. You could know nothing and learn how to cook from that book.
That's right. She's absolutely wonderful. And, you know, she's been a friend as my shop has gone along. I've gotten to know her more and more. And it's amazing to go from coaching her on the phone. I remember she was really at a low point trying to write the book and feeling really depressed about some of the aspects of it that weren't working for her to, you know, seeing this published and be a huge hit. And now she's going on to make a Netflix show around it. And it's just really exciting because she's gotten more and more confident and deservedly so. It's such a great book.
So I guess the next question would be trends or a certain type of cuisine that you've seen a lot this year. I know what my pick would be for those.
What is it?
Well, just the Silk Road books.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's so much that's international and exciting. People, I actually just have a cookbook that's coming in. I haven't gotten to see it yet, called The Immigrant Cookbook. And I'm really excited about that. I think, you know, in response to the travel ban being on, being off, being on, and people being aware of certain countries and their residents not being allowed into the country, they've gotten much more interested in learning about them through their cuisine, which is kind of the best way to get to know any culture, I think. Certainly a lot of Middle Eastern books are still really popular. I see a lot of Syrian ones coming up. And then for some reason, people are really interested in Georgia and Azerbaijan. I haven't tried that cuisine yet, but apparently it's people come back from there raving, so much so that there have been a few cookbooks that have come out, like Caucasus from Ulia Hercules in London, that are just huge hits.
And also Istanbul and Beyond?
Yeah, Istanbul and Beyond is by Robin Eckhart, and her husband Dave Hagerman took the pictures. And what I love about that book is it's not just Istanbul and what we think of as Turkish cuisine, kofta and kebabs and things like that. But they actually traveled a lot up north to the Black Sea and then all the way to the east, almost to Syria, and found a lot of those cuisines as well. And then in the beautiful category is a Silk Road book that I am absolutely in love with called The Grammar of Spice. And it's by Kaz Hildebrand, who is a designer in London. She designs all of Nigella Lawson's books and has done a few others. This book is so beautiful. It's basically an encyclopedia of spices with a little bit of recipes and more sort of how to use the spices in a recipe and descriptions of the spices that are sort of personal and also historic. Just stunning designs that she did for each page that almost look like Isnik pottery from Turkey. I mean, they're absolutely gorgeous. So I love that book and that way to explore spices in general.
Okay, what about for the baker this year?
Oh, for the baker, there's so much. Brave Tart by Stella Parks has been getting so much attention, and it is really, really wonderful. It's all American baking. The thing that makes a successful baking book, I think, is something that's well-tested. Everything comes out perfectly as you expect it. And it's not too finicky, but, you know, sometimes with baking, you have to be a lot more careful, which is why I'm not a baker. It's, you know, you really, really have to follow the recipes. And if you do, and if the book is good, they'll come out right. So Stella Parks' book is fabulous, Brave Tart. But also The Artful Baker, I don't think I can pronounce his name. Cenk is his first name, and he's Turkish. He's got a very popular blog about baking that he told me that there's really no baking in Turkey. They do simit and things like that. They've got some savory baking, but baked sweets are not a thing there. And in fact, when he first started his blog, he had to bring back from America spatulas and whisks and things like that because they just didn't have them for sale there. And that's become really popular with people in Turkey. And then his book is gorgeous and has done really, really well here.
What about cocktails?
Cocktails, the new Jim Meehan's bartender manual is wonderful. You know, he wrote the PDT cocktail book and also owns that bar in New York, which is a little speakeasy and an early speakeasy, early for the aughts, I should say. So that book is heavy and beautiful and got lots of photos. It's a really nice one. And then also there's a really nice cocktail. How do I explain this? It's sort of a cocktail memoir. It's by an author up here named Thad Vogler, who really helped start the modern cocktail craze, artisanal cocktail craze up here. He owns a place called Bar Agricole, and he wrote a book called By the Smoke and the Smell, and it's all about traveling around the world and discovering interesting liquors that are not owned by corporations. And he's very into, you know, discovering those and bringing them up here to the United States. And whether it's mezcal or scotch or, you know, gin, whatever he's finding. I really liked reading about his travels. And there are other great memoirs and histories too. John T. Edge's Potlicker Papers, A Modern History of the South is fascinating. It does not sugarcoat anything. And it also looks a lot at, I think it starts in like the 50s or 60s. So it really is a modern history. So in that case, it talks a lot about the immigrants that are in the South, like Vietnamese immigrants and Mexican immigrants, and, you know, as well as that African-American community, of course, who have been there for a very long time. So that's a really interesting sort of look at the past. And then Laura Shapiro, who's a well-known food historian, wrote a book called What She Ate, about a number of different women. I think only one of them actually was a cookbook writer or had anything to do with writing about food. The rest of them were just people in history, and she was interested in what they were eating at the time and how it influenced their work. So I loved that. And then a couple of really wonderful autobiographies, memoirs. One was Barbara Lynch's Out of Line. She's a chef in Boston and owns quite a number of restaurants out there. Her book is just a wonderful, you can hear her Boston accent through the writing and the way that she takes you through her childhood up through her career and this sort of rough and tumble beginning, very Southy life, and how she worked her way up and gained her own confidence to run her kitchens is just a lovely read. And also, I have to say, I really, really loved Alice Waters' new memoir that she has, Coming to My Senses. You know, she started Chez Panisse, but this is pretty much all about her life before that and how she got inspired. And there are two sort of criticisms that Alice Waters gets a lot, being a very public person. One is that she doesn't give credit where credit is due, and the other is that she has unfair expectations of everyone shopping at farmers markets and buying organic food. This book and knowing her dispute that. One is that she gives credit where all credit is due in this book and talks about where her influences came from and her beginnings working as a girl in a movie, you know, one of those outdoor movie theaters where she was rolling around on roller skates delivering hamburgers to people's car windows. Just the way that she grew up, which is wonderful and free, and there's a lot of sex and a lot of drinking, and it's totally fun and unexpected for her. And the other point is that, you know, I feel like, especially in this day and age, there is not enough room for utopians in our world. And it's really great to have one. And it's okay to reach for the stars, even if you're not going to get there. I think it's wonderful to have someone that really wants to push us as far as she can to be as good to ourselves as we can.
What about The Cooking Gene?
The Cooking Gene, yes, Michael Twitty. Really wonderful and interesting look at Southern food. And he's African-American, Jewish, gay, and he's got everything going for him. And he's just really out there to talk about it. And he works part-time at Colonial Williamsburg and does the reenactments there. And it's just really, really fascinating hearing his attention to the past and how he sees it from those angles of who he is and how he sees things developing.
Yeah, it's really a good year for memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
So we said that it wasn't, that we were moving away from the big coffee table book, but was there one this year that stuck out for you?
There are three that I love that are not huge and unwieldy. One is Leave Me Alone with the Recipes by Sipi Pinellas.
She was the first female graphic designer, head of the graphic design department for Condé Nast.
That's right. And Wendy McNaughton, who illustrated Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, was at the San Francisco Antiquarian Book Fair a couple of years ago and discovered an album of original watercolors by Sipi Pinellas that were absolutely beautiful and had these handwritten recipes with them. And she and a bunch of friends got together and bought the book and decided to get it published. And someone in New York actually decided it was worth publishing. And the illustrations are absolutely gorgeous. They were done in the 1940s. And now there's all this interest in her, which is great. I heard that there might even be a retrospective of her work at the High Museum in Atlanta. And then France is a Feast by Alex Prudhomme is fabulous. And Katie Pratt, who found all of the photos and or at least curated them of that Paul Child took of him and Julia Child when they were living in Paris and in the south of France. Those are always really fun to look at. And it turns out that Paul Child really was more than an amateur photographer. He really would have liked to have made that his career. And you can really sense that in the photos. And then the last one is Chasing Beaucoup's by Philippe Tessier, who used to be the sous chef over at the French Laundry. And he and his team won the first gold medal for America at the Beaucoup's d'Or, which is this huge and crazy cooking competition that happens every 2 years in France. And that is really fun to see their journey and also all the food that they created.
This year, we saw the demise of Lucky Peach very, very sadly.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other food-focused magazines that we should be aware of?
Yes, there are some great new ones coming out. There's one called Dill Magazine that's done by a sophomore in high school, and it's all about Asian food. I really love it. I think it's very cool. And then also a new one by a guy up here named Nick Muncie, and it's called Toothache. And it's about professional cooking, both sweet and savory. He's on the sweet side. So it's nice because it's about half and half. And I think both of those are really fun and interesting. And of course, Cherry Bomb has been out there for a few years. And I love that. It's all about women in the food business.
Okay, so finish this sentence. In 2018, we're going to see a lot of...
Books from Eastern Europe. I don't know why, but there's like a real big interest. I think there's going to be a lot of comfort food. I think we need a lot of comfort right now. And so I think we're going to start seeing a lot of warm, cozy foods from places like Eastern Europe that can fill our bellies and our hearts.
Well, thank you so much, Celia.
Thank you. It's always great to talk to you.
That's Celia Sack, owner of Omnivore Books on Food in San Francisco. We checked in with her just before the holidays for a roundup of the year's best cookbooks. You can find them on the Good Food blog. Just go visit blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, we have another great holiday idea for you. That's when the show continues. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. In the late 90s, Terry Gelber was at the epicenter of LA's culinary renaissance. She worked with the likes of Nancy Silverton and Wolfgang Puck. Terry was even one of the first producers I worked with here at Good Food. She's in Portland now, where she owns a tea company called Tea Project. That's the letter T. Just in time for the holidays, she's talking to me about the beauty of blending teas, like a chef blends flavors. Hello, Terry.
Hi, Evan.
What do you say to someone who says, I am just not a tea person?
I believe them. I know that they're not. But I think that I can persuade them to find a tea that they might enjoy. That could be a very tart citrus tea, like California Dreamin' with ginger and spices and hibiscus. That could be a smoky tea, the smoke on the water. I kind of take it more into the food vantage point, you know, the flavor profiles. And just like coffee has all these, you know, different flavor profiles, my teas have a huge spectrum of flavor profiles. So I kind of find out what they're about. You know, do you like rich and smooth and buttery, creamy flavors, or do you like minty flavors? And I just take it from there. And I can usually find something that somebody connects to.
So what would be the rich and smooth and buttery flavor?
I would say Goodyear for the Roses. It's a white tea. And there's some floral stuff going on there. There's some roses, a tiny bit of lavender, but the tea itself is the main component here. It's a premium Bai Mu Dan, a white peony tea from Fujian province. It is kind of buttery on the palate, very accessible, nothing strong, not too tannic, just a really beautiful, elegant, kind of round tea.
I mean, first of all, you live in Portland, like ground zero for crazy coffee obsessives. In an environment that is so heavily caffeinated, is tea something that can suit the lifestyle of people who want to be brought up? Or is tea, even though it's caffeinated, meant to give us a reason to pause?
I think both. You know, you can start your day with coffee and move into tea later on. Different teas have different quantities of caffeine. You can have a lighter hojicha in the afternoon so that you're not up late at night. It still gives you a tiny bit of a lift, but not going to keep you up till 4 a.m. like a good strong cappuccino might.
You know, I did have the hojicha, and was I correct in noticing that there were dehydrated carrots in there?
Yes. So the dehydrated carrots, they just add a little sort of vegetal sweetness to the tea. I grind them and also put them in whole, so you don't see the orange powder so much. And then I also add toasted buckwheat and some cardamom and a little bit of cinnamon. I don't like cinnamon to overwhelm my teas. I do like cinnamon, but I find that most tea blenders and most bigger tea companies tend to overdo it.
So I have to ask you, how did you end up discovering tea and sort of falling into the rabbit hole of having it sort of take your life in a different direction in Portland?
My entry point was when I was about 15. I worked at the old Santa Monica Mall before it was an inside mall. We're talking about the early 70s, early to mid 70s. I had a job on the mall at a boutique, and I would take my paycheck every 2 weeks, and the first thing I would do was to treat myself to a proper tea at the Tudor House, which was a great British tea room. I think it was on Wilshire and Forth at the time. I don't know. Is that still around?
Yes, it is still there.
So I loved to go there. I thought it was like a special thing. I'd go by myself, like a 15-year-old girl, like walking in. They'd seat me. I'd have the cart of beautiful little English pastries and a pot of tea. But as I traveled the world more, backpacking around Europe and discovering great tea shops, I realized there was quite a big world of tea out there that nobody really told me about. So I started to just bring home tea from other places. I would go to Chato, the tea room in LA. And then when I moved up to Portland, you know, these long, cold, wet winters, it's pouring right now outside. You want to drink hot things. You want to eat soup and drink hot things all day long. So I delved into tea. I was doing some food writing at the time, and having worked with sort of some of the best chefs, I think, in the country, Nancy Silverton and Suzanne Gowen and you, Wolf, I wasn't finding the food scene here back then as exciting. So anyways, I started to get more into tea, started playing around with blends, using my history of the food world and all of that great experience with you chefs to try botanical ingredients that other people weren't using in tea. So I messed around with cocoa beans, cacao nibs, and I started trying to do that in a little tiny basement. And little by little, I started to grow my wholesale accounts. And then a couple years ago, I opened a little shop a few days a week where people can come by and sample. That was that.
I love it. Thank you so much, Terry.
Thank you, Evan. It was so great to talk to you again.
I've been talking with Terry Gelber, owner of Tea Project. You can find her specialty tea blends at teaprojectshop.com. That's the letter T. Now a dispatch from the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Laura Avery has an update on how our farmer friends are doing as wildfires rage on in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery. I'm the Santa Monica Wednesday Farmers Market Manager. It is Wednesday, December 6th. We're in the second or third day of these awful, devastating fires that are happening. Farmers who are affected in the burn areas, a lot of them have no electricity. Some of them had to leave their homes. Some of them have not gotten back to know if the home is still standing. We know for sure that Mud Creek Ranch lost all their outbuildings and their vehicles. The family is safe, and they trying to save the house with fire hoses. This was as of yesterday. Coastal Farm, also in Santa Paula, that's Mark Carpenter. They evacuated. They're not sure if the farm is still there or if the house is still there. Friends Ranch in Ojai on Tuesday, this is Tuesday the 5th, Emily Thatcher reported winds were so strong that she said her entire crop is on the ground. That would be their pixie tangerines and a lot of their, well, all their citrus fruit. So strong winds caused that. And Rincon del Mar, who brings us the wonderful cherimoyas and the passion fruit and the guavas, left the market early today on the 6th of December because the farm, the La Conchita fire, had now come up to the edges of the ranch, and I guess it's all hands on deck up there. So the fires are unstable and growing fast, and it's now Wednesday, 6th of December. So all of our thoughts and hopes and wishes are with the farmers. And if you go to the Santa Monica Farmers Market website or follow us on any of our social media platforms, we are providing updates as we get them when we can on how the farmers are doing. The best thing anyone can do is come to the market and shop here and support the farmers and be here for them now when they need us the most.
For more on the wildfires, here's Maricela Morales. We spoke on Wednesday. She's the executive director of CAUSE, which works with farm workers and farmers in Ventura County. Hi, Maricela.
Hi, Evan.
Talk to me a bit about the devastation that you've seen this week.
It's like nothing we've seen here as far as I can recall. I've grown up in Ventura County, and so going on over 40 years, and I don't recall ever having a fire like this. And the Santa Ana winds are just making it uncontainable. So that just adds to the feeling of concern and trepidation.
Now, I know you work a lot with farm workers. Have you spoken to anyone who's already feeling displacement in terms of lost housing?
At this point, the greatest concern that we've had is farm workers who are still having to go out and work. The focus has been on going out into the fields and letting them know about their rights to either remain home or, you know, go somewhere else that's safe and not feel like they have to be at work under these conditions, and that their employer is required by law to provide them with masks. So our biggest concern really right now is around their health and safety at the job.
Because there are farmers that are still expecting people to work despite the burden of smoke inhalation.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the fires have been mostly on the hillsides and in areas that aren't necessarily being cultivated. So that's not to say that farms and ag fields aren't being affected, but that's not where most of the fire is happening. And so farm workers that have an issue with their homes, you know, have shelters to go to, but we've seen them out throughout the week working. You know, we are feeling it inside working in an office. We feel it in our respiratory system, you know, coughing. And so, you know, we're concerned about farm workers that are on the field. You know, according to the Air Quality Control District, people throughout Ventura County are encouraged not to have a heavy physical exertion inside or outside. And, you know, here we have farm workers that are still out in the fields. And so throughout the day, we've been going out and handing out masks to workers and letting them know that, you know, by law, their employer should be providing these masks, and that if they feel that their health is being, you know, severely compromised, you know, they should feel safe to remain away from work and shouldn't fear retaliation.
Thank you so much for sharing this story with us. Thank you, Maricela.
Appreciate your covering it. Thank you.
That's Maricela Morales, Executive Director of CAUSE in Ventura County. She's been talking about the effect on farm workers of the wildfires devastating her area. Did you ever dream about buying a small place in Paris and fixing it up? Well, you might want to talk to David Leibovitz first. It's after the break. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. This idea of having a disaster is the reason why I haven't done anything to my house in 30 years.
Usually that's what most people, you know, they hear the word renovation, and they're like, you know what, I think I can live with the toilet, but I have to lift the lid off every time I have to flush it, or, you know, the kitchen sink that's got the crack in it, because they just don't want someone to come over because they know it's going to be a problem.
That's chef and author David Leibovitz. Over the years, David's written on his popular blog about relocating to Paris from the U.S. In 2012, he bought an apartment there and began the process of renovating it. It sounds like the stuff of dreams, but it was actually a comedy of errors. He's written about it in a new book called L'Appart.
Well, I lived in a little rooftop apartment, and when I first moved to Paris, you know, I'd come from San Francisco, I had a house, you know, and I was, you know, it was fine, I had a garage and storage, I had a dryer. And so I moved to Paris, and I was living in a small rooftop apartment that was très charmant. And they use the same real estate keywords in France, cozy, charming, original, things like that to describe unusual spaces. But it was really actually a really sweet apartment. It was a little, a lot of Americans go, I want to move to France. I'm like, well, downsize your life, do what I did. I had a great view of the Eiffel Tower. I didn't have any neighbors on any side of me. I was on the roof. The one downside of rooftop apartments, which people don't understand, is in the summer, the zinc roof bakes you. And it used to, the temperature would get in my apartment between like 105, 110 degrees.
And you're a pastry chef.
Yeah, and all my which means chocolate. All my chocolate was melting everywhere. But it was really a lovely apartment, but I needed more space. It was time. I'd been living in Paris for 10 years. I thought, I need to buy my own apartment.
When you embark on that, choosing the neighborhood must be huge because often the neighborhood you can afford to rent in is very different than the neighborhood in which you can afford to buy.
Exactly. And that's a problem in a lot of places. People live in apartments for a long time and they say, oh, I really want to live in this neighborhood and I want this rooftop apartment. And then you go to buy it and it's like, ooh. So yeah, that was me gulping. I did want to stay in the same neighborhood because in Paris, there's something, it's called the bizutage, which in English means hazing. So when you live in a neighborhood, everyone knows you, the people at the market know you, the people at the bakery will pick out the baguette for you that you like, just cooked right. But when you move, you have to start all over again. And it takes about a year to get everyone in line with what you like and to meet everybody and let them know that you're a regular, you're part of that neighborhood now.
That is such a bizarre idea in our impersonal world.
There's a lot of stories about French customer service versus America customer service. But in America, the customer is always right. People are trained to say yes, and they're trained to do whatever you want. It's like, oh, my God, he wants this. You want to change the menu. I want the taco, but I don't want onions on it. And can I get that with cilantro on the side? It's like, sure, sure, sure. In France, the customer is not always right. A lot of it is because the concept of somebody who's a sales clerk, they're not there to serve you. They're there to, if you want to buy something, they will help you buy something. But their job is not to be, in servitude of you.
So you finally find a place.
Yes, and that was after 5 years of looking. Because in France, there's no multiple listing. So half the properties are sold by word of mouth. They're just people talking about them. Oh, yeah, my friend's selling their apartment. So everything takes a long time. And French people also like the process. They love the process. The result is not so important. It's the process of meeting the person. You go there and the seller is at the house, because they're often the seller. In America, you're just like, I don't like it, bye. So you have to have coffee with them.
And your seller was a little interesting.
He was very interesting. He was kind of like a cartoon character, and he just kept jumping up and down. And usually when, a good rule of thumb is to buy something from someone that wants to sell you something. That's sort of the implicit agreement. He kind of did everything he could to hold up the sale. He'd walk out of the meetings where we were signing the papers because it was taking too long. And we're all sitting there going, well, if you walk out, it's going to take longer. Once again, logic doesn't, it's a different sense of logic. It's prolonging, the drama, the process.
So you decide on an apartment. What kind of condition was it in?
It was actually an old metal shop that had been sort of roughly converted to a living space. There was sort of walls put up. A lot of people rent apartments and they just kind of make do. You build temporary walls. And it was sort of a makeshift space. There was a lot of, in French, there's an expression called cache misère, which means to hide the misery. So there'll be these beautiful stone walls, but they'll cover them up with plaster because it sort of hides the past, the misery of the past. And now, we're all like, let's expose those. Let's see this beautiful stonework. My partner didn't like the space. He's like, it's not good. This is not a good idea. And, once again, I should have listened to him. I said, no, this is great. Well, I'm going to tear this wall down. I'm going to move the kitchen over here, make it bigger. It's just going to be a few cosmetic things. I like your laugh. And now I can laugh about it, too. I was like, oh, this is going to be easy.
So I just have to ask you, did writing about it help you bind the pain?
It did, because, you know, it was a very difficult situation, and I wrote about it in the book. It also helped to explain it, what happened, to myself and to readers. A lot of readers really are engaged. It's interesting that people are saying, I was so with you at every step of the way, and I turned the page, I was, like, so engrossed in your, you know, anxiety, the stress, but also, you know, your good humor and so forth. So people were really engaged with it. And it did help me to write about it, because often distance makes you see the reality, but you can see, you know, the forest through the trees. You know, one of my most frequently asked questions is, why'd you move to France? And I never had an answer. I wasn't like somebody whose kitchen in San Francisco was full of Eiffel Tower potholders and, you know, those jars of olive oil that, you know, with all the garlic in it, it looks like they were from France. You know, I was never that kind of Francophile, but I was very involved in French cooking and cooking in general.
So the kitchen would be paramount for this space.
Yeah, the main reason to do to get a new apartment was also to have a nice kitchen, because I spend 90% of my life in the kitchen and the other 5% in the bathroom. Another bathroom, whoops, in the bedroom. There's a few bathroom stories in the book, so people will have to indulge me. But, you know, I cook for a living, and so having a refrigerator, most refrigerators in Paris are very tiny. You know, my refrigerator is kind of a tool of my trade. I needed a big refrigerator. I needed a real oven, not a little toaster oven-sized oven. So that was sort of important to me when doing the apartment.
And how easy was it to get those things?
How long do we have?
Well, to me, it's like the challenge is there's so many easily available choices here.
Well, there's usually a process to finding things. Like, everyone loves finding a sink. In French, there's several different words for sink. There's about 5 different words. I'm like, oh, I want a white sink. If it has a divider, it's called something else. It's not called an évier. It's called a bassin or lave-main. If it's a small one, it's a hand-washing sink, you know. So everything is compartment. Even toilets, you know, you have to order them. So I would ask for things, and sort of like, no, we don't have that. I'm like, but that's it right there. And they're like, oh, ça va, it's the same thing. I also had to learn numbers, and that's a big challenge for even French people, the numbers, because they don't just say 97. It's like 4 times 20 plus 10 plus 7.
For the sizes.
For everything. You know, these people are, you know, giving you dimensions. They're like, 1099 par, da-da-da-da-da, and I'm going, okay, can you write it down for me?
So... then for cabinets and such, you would just go to IKEA, right? I mean, they have IKEA.
Yes, IKEA is sort of a necessary evil if you live in Europe. That's everything folds up. So when you have a little European apartment, you want a dining room table that can unfold to seat 6, but small enough that you could just squeeze it under the space by the window. One good thing about IKEA is they have plain things. They have stainless steel. They have white. A lot of stuff, even in America, but in Europe as well, it's decorated. You know, a big thing in France is colored sinks, colored kitchen cabinets. Like, aubergine is sort of a running theme through the book. They love purple. Everything's purple, purple, purple. Like, I'm not Prince. I don't want to live in a purple house. I don't want a purple kitchen. I want a white kitchen with stainless steel stuff. And the simple things are always the hardest to find in France.
One of the things that fascinated me was the power that other tenants had over you.
Mm-hmm.
And not just this bizutage, but legal
right.
power.
Well, you're living in sort of a condo or co-op situation. If anyone from New York can relate to the co-op board, all this power they have over you. In France, a friend of mine who works in real estate, she said, never let the neighbors know they have power over you. Because a lot of people in France, and this is not an insult, but a lot of them are 1 or 2 generations removed from being very rural people. And, you know, we have that Hatfield versus McCoy's mentality in America. It's like, this is my land, you know, this is da-da-da-da-da, and, you know, sort of a distrust of neighbors. And, you know, the French have always been invaded, you know, especially in Paris, they've always, you know, people have always tried to get into the city and take over. Now it's me, people like me. but, you know, the one thing you want to make sure is that you don't let them know that they have power over you because they can block projects and so forth. That said, I'm very good friends with my neighbors now. So if anybody's listening and they read the book, it's interesting how things have turned and people respect me now because I've been there. I went through the hazing. And that's part of life in France, and that makes you French.
Well, I'm so glad that you took all this pain and you turned it into this gold. It's like reading a mystery thriller.
Uh-huh.
Thank you so much, David.
Oh, thanks. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I love coming on your show.
That's professional cook, baker, and writer David Leibovitz. We've been discussing his time in Paris and his new book, La Part. Now a restaurant recommendation from our friend Jonathan Gold. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
Where are you taking us this week?
We're going to West Hollywood to a restaurant called Verlaine in the former Dominic space.
Verlaine. Okay, so it makes me think that it's going to be French.
It made me think it would be French, too. It's a Mexican place, or the new style of Mexican place, which used to be absolutely unobtainable in America and now seems to be opening in Los Angeles pretty regularly. The chef here is Diego Hernandez, who has a restaurant called Corazon de Tierra in Valle de Guadalupe that's pretty much considered the best restaurant in Baja, at least by some people. It came in 34th in the best restaurants in Latin America. And Verlaine had a rough opening. It's pretty cocktail-oriented. The food is plain. If you're expecting bells and whistles Mexican food, it's not that. Some of the food is spicy, but it's not all. And it was apparently pretty sloppy early on. But it is one of the best Mexican restaurants in Los Angeles. I mean, it's way up there.
Okay, so since I have a bean fixation, I have to ask you about the beans.
I think these are the best beans I've ever tasted, or at least the best Mexican beans I've ever tasted in California.
That's like a throwdown kind of statement.
They are spectacular.
What kind of beans are they?
They're black beans. They're sort of soft fried, which means they're not really, they're mashed a little bit. They're creamy. You can taste the herbs. The epazote isn't just that weird feral stink. It's clear and fragrant and delicious. And there's like also a fragrance, but you can't really find the presence of cecina, dried beef, just under the surface, giving it sort of a umami thing. There's also tiny cubes of queso fresco.
So it's delicious.
It's so good. And it's served with the best flour tortillas, small, crispy, pulley, really lovely fragrance. And sometimes you wish you could just go there and order beans and tortillas and have your dinner like that.
Well, they're priced in a way that you should be able to just order those.
You probably could. It's $11. And I'm sure if you go for drinks and you want beans and tortillas, they'll be there for you on that.
Okay, but let's go beyond the beans and tortillas. What are we looking for here? Is it a taco place or is it a considered plated experience?
There are tacos occasionally. I mean, you can find the taco, but it's not a taco place. It's a small menu, and sometimes it leans towards seafood, right? There's a aguachile made with scallops, which, you know, it's a really spicy green ceviche, and the scallops are just absolutely fresh. I mean, they taste hours out of the sea. There's cactus salad with, like, little bits of jellied chicharrones in it and fresh cheese. There's octopus ceviche that's crisped over a fire a little bit, so there's a smokiness to it. There's a lot of smoke. There's a lot of chili. There's a little bit of sweetness and always a sort of umami-ish tartness to a lot of the dishes. And he serves one of my favorite dishes there, weirdly enough, is carrots. They're just roasted carrots, but they're served with a sort of super fresh, super pungent salad of carrot tops and pumpkin seeds.
You have changed so much.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I like those tacos we were talking about, you know, stuffed with octopus or grilled fish or the smoked chicken enchiladas. Oh, my Lord, you have to try the enchiladas. they're folded. They actually look more like tacos than the tacos do, actually, which are kind of on the flat side. They come in a sauce, like a chili sauce. And there's a little bit of what they call a salsa macha, which is a Baja-style oil made with guajillo chilies and with burnt peanuts. There's a lot of seafood there, but they have one of the better roast chickens in town, oddly. It's hung for 3 days like a Peking duck with like a fan on it. It's roasted over fire. The skin comes out crunchy and also a little bit chewy. The meat of the chicken has that dry brine quality, which is to say it's perfectly seasoned all the way through. It's not overdone, but it doesn't have that slackness sometimes that you get with chicken that's cooked slightly pink at the bone, which this tends to be. And it's served with a small, super rich puddle of what they're calling salsa madre, kind of a red wine demi-glace that they've kept going for years.
Any other highlights on the menu cocktail-wise, or do we not need to go there?
You know me, I'm a peasant. I go to restaurants like this and I drink either wine, and the wine list is fine, or mezcal. I always like mezcal. And they have almost all the different kinds from Vago, which is one of the better mezcal brands.
Well, this place sounds great. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Glad to be here, Evan.
That's Jonathan Gold on Vera Lane in West Hollywood. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Coming up, a look at the mysteries of panettone, the Christmas bread that keeps bakers up at night. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Chef Roy Schwarzappel is a classically trained pastry chef who's worked at some of the most prestigious spots around the world, places like El Bulli or Bouchon Bakery. The list goes on. But he spent the better part of a decade pursuing one thing, panettone, the Italian sweet bread that's especially popular around the holidays. Hi, Roy.
Hi.
I'm so excited to talk to you, being a panettone aficionado myself, as an eater. So most of us sort of think of it maybe as a slightly richer, slightly less dense challah that's studded with, or brioche, studded with fruit.
Yeah, yeah. So often it gets always put in that in the category of like fruitcake, brioche, or challah dough with fruit. You know, any which variation or combination of words like that is often the way most people would describe it, and it's drastically incorrect. It's very different than brioche, not only in methodology, but also in the way that it eats. And I don't say that as someone who does this for a living and, you know, claim to have some sort of refined palate. I think even the layperson, if I handed them a well-made brioche and a well-made panettone, if you ask them, can you tell that these two items are not the same? They would say, of course.
So describe for me your first encounter with what is real, true, sort of high-level panettone.
So I was working for Pierre May in Paris. And this is, I want to say, 12 years ago in this, you know, as I perceived it to be the mecca of the world's pastry kitchens with some spectacular young pastry chefs and cooks. And then I was, you know, at the bottom of the totem pole. But one thing that was quite obvious was the one item that brought the most amount of anxiety, stress, fear to the staff was the production of panettone. Now, again, I'm walking in and my only reference point is, isn't this like $6.99 borderline inedible product that is on like supermarket shelves? And here I see famed patisserie making this product that obviously looks nothing like what I know. And it is, you know, bringing the kitchen down. And I can't understand why. I remember when I tasted it for the first time. So it was a transcendental moment for me. Like, I'd never tasted anything like this before. And of course, I'd eaten tons of bread in my life, good, bad, and awful, but I've eaten a lot of bread, but I've never had anything that just disintegrated in my mouth and was light and rich at the same time. And I just couldn't stop eating it, not from a it's delicious, but I was eating it and like I could eat more and I wasn't full and it was so easily consumed and I just didn't understand any of it.
So I understand that you went to Italy to study with the maestro of this particular oeuvre. Who was
it? As I like to coin him, the Michael Jordan of the world of panettone, Eugenio Massari. And the only reason I knew about him, you know, at this early stage in my journey was, you know, at one point in my time in Paris, I was told that, you know, Mr. Hermé, you know, 2.5 decades prior, he went to Italy to learn how to make panettone from this guy named Eugenio Massari. Great. Fast forward to my time right after my time at PRMA at El Bulli. And I, you know, of course, make some wonderful Italian friends as they were there for that season. And my best friend at the time had joined El Bulli from working for Paco Torreblanca in Spain, who is, I would say, Spain's version of Pierre May, right? I mean, just he's on the Mount Rushmore of pastry chefs. And he had a shop in the city that El Bulli was in. And in that shop, they sold panettone. So I buy one. I eat it, and I'm blown away like I was from the Pierre May one. And my friend, who I knew worked for Paco Torreblanca, I was like, wait, do you make this? He's like, yes. And we're talking about it. Like, it's incredible. It's so similar to what I had at Pierre May. And long story short, he tells me, yeah, earlier in his life, he traveled to Italy and he also learned how to make panettone. I'm like, oh, cool. Where did he go? He's like, oh, he went to this guy, Eugenio Massari. I'm like, okay, that's it. I'm going. I got to learn how to make this.
So let's talk about this strange bread. First of all, a bit about its provenance. Where did it come from? Who started making it? And then maybe we could talk a little bit about the process.
Panettone is deeply rooted in, I think, a lot of mythology, which I love, right? I embrace it. It doesn't matter to me if it's true or not, right? I think it's part of the folklore. So the story goes that there was this, of course, peasant baker who was trying to court, you know, the king's daughter and wanted to make something lavish and amazing. So he decided he was going to take some old bread dough that might have been overly fermented or whatever and, you know, embellish it with more sugar and honey and these expensive candied fruits. And, you know, they executed from there, hence born panettone. And yes, his name allegedly was Tony, Panettone, panettone.
You know. No way.
Oh, totally. This is like Italian folklore. Again, does it really matter if it's true? I mean, I don't care. You know, I mean, it's not influencing public policy or anything like that. It's just fun. I like to go to bed at night and tell myself that that's probably the way it happened.
I always thought it was panettone, meaning one, which in Italian, that ending means big. So I always thought it referred to the dome of it.
If we're going to bring logic into the equation, that's probably more accurate, but less fun.
Okay, so let's talk about how it's made.
The heart of this product, this process, and what differentiates it from, let's say, brioche or traditional challah, you know, is it's not made with commercial yeast. This is a wild cultivated yeast. Yeast, you know, being something that lives around us everywhere, right? So it's just basically flour and water that if you let sit for long enough, will begin to ferment and life is born. And from there, you have to care for this. You know, you have to care for it, dare I say, like a child, but like a child, right? It's got feelings, it's got thoughts, and it might not want to cooperate on certain days, and it might be cranky. Consistency is something you have to force it to be. So that in and of itself is quite an undertaking and is not for the faint of heart. So this is the core of panettone. Now, once you've got that part seemingly under control, now you get into the actual process of making this Mount Everest of baked goods. And it's about a all-in, including the time it cools upside down, which we'll get into. It's about 40 hours. And it's not negotiable. It's just not forgiving that way. And by not forgiving, I mean impossible. It just won't work. So the process begins on a first day where you have your wild yeast that you've cared for passionately. And you have to feed it every 3.5-4 hours. Its food is flour. So flour and water, and you're building it up, right? It ferments, and then you take it, and you put it back in the mixer, and you give it more flour and water, and you keep building it and building it. And you do that 3 times. After the 3rd time, you then mix your first dough. When in that first dough, you have flour, water, sugar, butter, egg yolks, and this yeast. It's a very long mix. It's about 35 or 40 minutes. It goes for an overnight proof. The monitoring of how it's moving and its pH levels are also critical, right? If the pH levels are getting out of control, it means something's not right. And if something's not right and you're not aware of it and you continue with the process, the house is going to come crashing down.
So we're at that place where we've done the first mix and the first proof. Then what happens?
So then you're pulling that out of the proofer, and now you're getting into the final mix. Final mix is much more stringent in terms of the way it's mixed. And at this point, you're really focused on the idea of an emulsion. You have lots of fats, lots of waters, and you can't just add everything at once, you know, 20 or 30 minutes, and then you're dividing the dough to whatever weights you're gonna make that day, and you pre-shape it. You let it rest 10, 15 minutes. You do your final shape, put it in the mold, and then it goes in for its final fermentation. This can take anywhere from, I've seen it as short as 4 hours, and I've seen it as long as 10. And people ask me, well, how do you know? You do it long enough, you know when it's ready, and it all depends on the health and vibrancy of your yeast.
So let's say that we're done.
Yes.
We're baked. We come out of the oven. Talk to me about the flipping it upside down.
There's so much fermentation happening in advance of the Panettone process that by the time you get to the oven and it's baking, you know, it's on the verge of collapse because so much of its energy, protein, strength has been used and exhausted that it just begins to collapse on itself. So you have to get it upside down very quickly and let gravity do its thing until it comes to room temperature, which is anywhere, you know, from 6 to 8 hours. And then when you flip it back over, it feels like you have something magical. It really does.
That was Roy Schwarzappel. He's the owner of Panettone from Roy from the Bay Area. You can find his loaves on thisisfromroy.com and at Williams-Sonoma stores. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, or download our show wherever you get your podcasts, like Spotify. Thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.